This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents London Bridges, written by James Patterson and read by Peter J. Fernandez and Dennis O'Hare.
Prologue. The Weasel returns. And what a nice surprise.
Chapter 1.
Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer loved his new life in Salvador, Brazil's third largest city, and some would say its most intriguing. It was definitely the most fun. He had rented a plush six-bedroom villa directly across from Guarajuba Beach, where he spent his days drinking sweet caipirinhas and ice-cold Brahma beers, or sometimes playing tennis at the club. At night, Colonel Schaefer, the psychopathic killer, better known as the Weasel, was up to his old tricks, hunting on the dark, narrow, winding streets of the old city. He had lost count of his kills in Brazil, and nobody in Salvador seemed to care or even keep count. There hadn't been a single newspaper story about the disappearance of young prostitutes. Not one. Maybe it was true what they said of the people here. When they weren't actually partying, they were already rehearsing for the next one. At a few ticks past 2 a.m, Schaefer returned to the villa with a young and beautiful streetwalker who called herself Maria. What a gorgeous face the girl had, and a stunning brown body, especially for someone so young. Maria said she was only 13. The Weasel picked a fat banana from one of several plants in his yard. At this time of year, he had his choice of coconut, guava, mango, and piña, which was sugar apple. As he plucked the fresh fruit, he had the thought that there was always something ripe for the taking in Salvador. It was paradise. Well, maybe it's hell, and I'm the devil, Schaefer thought, and chuckled to himself. For you, Maria, he said, handing her the banana. We'll put it to good use. The girl smiled knowingly, and the Weasel noticed her eyes. What perfect brown eyes. And all mine now. Eyes, lips, breasts. Just then, he spotted a small Brazilian monkey called a Mico, trying to work its way through a window screen and into his house. Get out of here, you thieving little bastard, he yelled. Go on, beat it. There came a quick movement from out of the bushes. Then 3 men jumped him. The police, he was certain. Probably Americans. Alex Cross? The cops were all over him, powerful arms and legs everywhere. He was struck down by a bat or a lead pipe, yanked back up by his full head of hair, then beaten unconscious. We got him. We got the Weasel on the first try. That wasn't very hard, said one of the men. Bring him inside. Then he looked at the beautiful young girl, who was clearly afraid, rightly so. You did a good job, Maria. You brought him to us. He turned to one of his men. Killer. A single gunshot ruptured the silence in the front yard. No one seemed to notice or care in Salvador.
Chapter 2.
The Weasel just wanted to die now. He was hanging upside down from the ceiling of his own master bedroom. The room had mirrors everywhere, and he could see himself in several of the reflections. He looked like death. He was naked, bruised, and bleeding all over. His hands were tightly cuffed behind his back, his ankles bound together, cutting off the circulation. Blood was rushing to his head. Hanging beside him was the young girl, Maria, but she had been dead for several hours, maybe as much as a day, judging by the terrible smell. Her brown eyes were turned his way, but they stared right through him. The leader of his captors, bearded, always squeezing a black ball in one hand, squatted down so that he was only a foot or so from Schaefer's face. He spoke softly, a whisper.
What we did with some prisoners when I was active, we would sit them down rather politely, peacefully, and then nail their fucking tongues to a table. That's absolutely true, my weaselly friend. You know what else? Simply plucking hairs from the nostrils, the chest, stomach, genitals. It's more than a little bothersome, no? Ouch, he said, as he plucked hairs from Schaefer's naked body. But I'll tell you the worst torture, in my opinion anyway. Worse than what you would have done to poor Maria. You grab the prisoner by both shoulders and shake violently until he convulses. You literally rattle his brain, the sensitive organ itself. He feels as if his head will fly off. His body is on fire. I'm not exaggerating. Here, let me show you what I mean. The terrible, unimaginably violent shaking, while Jeffrey Schaefer hung upside down, went on for nearly an hour. Finally, he was cut down. Who are you? What do you want from me? He screamed. The head captor shrugged. You're a tough bastard, but always remember, I found you, and I'll find you again if I need to. Do you understand? Jeffrey Schaefer could barely focus his eyes, but he looked up to where he thought the captor's voice had come from. He whispered, What do you want? Please. The bearded man's face bent close to his. He seemed almost to smile. I have a job, a most incredible job for you. Believe me, you were born for this. Who are you? The weasel whispered again through badly chapped and bleeding lips. It was a question he'd asked 100 times during the torture. I am the wolf, said the bearded man. Perhaps you've heard of me.
Part one.
The Unthinkable.
The Unthinkable.
Chapter 3.
On the sunny, blue-skied afternoon, when one of them would die unexpectedly, needlessly, Francis and Dougie Puzlowski were hanging sheets and pillowcases and the kids' play clothes out to dry in the noonday sun. Suddenly, U.S. Army soldiers began to arrive at their mobile home park, Azure Views, in Sunrise Valley, Nevada. Lots of soldiers. A full convoy of U.S. jeeps and trucks came bouncing up the dirt road they lived on and stopped abruptly. Troops poured out of the vehicles. The soldiers were heavily armed. They definitely meant business. What in the name of sweet Jesus is going on? Asked Dougie, who was currently on disability from the Cordy mine outside Wells and was still trying to get used to the domestic scene. But Dougie knew he was failing pretty badly. He was almost always depressed, always grumpy and mean-spirited, and always short with poor Francis and the kids. Dougie noticed that the soldier boys and girls climbing out of their trucks were outfitted in battle dress uniform, leather boots, camouflage pants, olive t-shirts, the whole kit and caboodle, as if this were Iraq and not the ass end of Nevada. They carried M16 rifles and ran toward the closest trailers with muzzles raised. Some of the soldiers even looked scared themselves. The desert wind was blowing pretty good, and their voices carried all the way to the Puzlowski's clothesline. Francis and Dougie clearly heard, We're evacuating the town. This is an emergency situation. Everyone has to leave their houses now. Now, people! Francis Puzlowski had the presence of mind to notice that all the soldiers were pretty much saying the same thing, as if they had rehearsed it, and that their tight, solemn faces sure showed that they wouldn't take no for an answer. The Pozlowskis' 300-odd neighbors, some of them very odd, were already leaving their mobile homes, complaining about it, but definitely doing as they were told. The next-door neighbor, Delta Shore, ran over to Francis.
"What's happening, hon? Why are all these soldiers here? My good God almighty, can you believe it? They must be from Nellis or Fallon or someplace. I'm a little scared, Francis. You scared, hon?"
The clothespin in Francis's mouth finally dropped to the ground as she spoke to Delta.
"They say they're evacuating us. I've got to get the girls."
Then Francis ran inside the mobile home, and at 240-some pounds, she had believed her sprinting or even jogging days were far behind her.
"Madison? Brett? Come here, you two. Nothing to be scared of. We just have to leave for a while. Oh, it'll be fun. Like a movie. Get a move on, you two."
The girls, ages 2 and 4, appeared from the small bedroom where they'd been watching Roly Poly Oly on the Disney Channel. Madison, the oldest, offered her usual,
"Why? Why do we have to? I don't want to. I won't. We're too busy, Mama."
Frances grabbed her cell phone off the kitchen counter, and then the next really strange thing happened. She tried to get a line to the police, but there was nothing except loud static. Now that had never happened before. Not that kind of annoying, buzzy noise she was hearing.
Was some kind of invasion going down? Something nuclear, maybe?
"Damn it," she snapped at the buzzing cell phone and almost started to cry.
"What is going on here?"
"You said a bad word,"
Brett squeaked. But she also laughed at her mother. She kind of liked bad words. It was as if her mother had made a mistake, and she loved it when adults made mistakes.
"Get Mrs. Summerkin an oink," Francis told the girls,
who would not leave the house without their two favorite loveys, not even if the infernal plague of Egypt had come to town. Francis prayed that it hadn't. But what had? Why was the U.S. Army swarming all over the place, waving scary guns in people's faces? She could hear her frightened neighbors outside verbalizing the very thoughts racing around in her head.
What's happened?
Who says we have to leave?
Tell us why.
Over my dead body, soldier. You hear me now?
That last voice was Dougie's.
Now what was he up to?
"Dougie, come back in the house," Francis yelled. "Help me with these girls, Dougie. I need you in here."
There was a gunshot outside. A loud lightning bolt crack exploded from one of the rifles. Francis ran to the screen door. Here she was, running again, and saw two U.S. Army soldiers standing over Dougie's body.
"Oh, my God. Dougie isn't moving. Oh, my God. Oh, my God."
The soldiers had shot him down like a rabid dog, for nothing. Francis started to shiver and shake, then threw up lunch. Her girl screeched,
"Yuck, Mommy! Mommy, yuck! You threw up all over the kitchen!"
Then suddenly a soldier, with a couple of days' facial growth on his chin, kicked open the screen door, and he was right in her face, and he was screaming,
"Get out of this trailer, now! Unless you want to die too."
The soldier had the business end of a gun pointed right at Francis.
"I'm not kidding, lady," he said. "Tell the truth, I'd just as soon shoot you as talk to you."
Chapter 4.
The job, the operation, the mission, was to wipe out an entire American town in broad daylight. It was some eerie psycho gig. Dawn of the Dead, either version, would be mild compared to this. Sunrise Valley, Nevada, population 315 brave souls, soon to be population 0. Who was going to believe it? Well, hell, everybody would in less than about 3 minutes. None of the men on board the small plane knew why the town was being targeted for extinction or anything else about the strange mission, except that it paid extremely well,
and all the money had been delivered to them up front. Hell, they didn't even know one another's names. All they had been told was their individual tasks for the mission, just their little piece of the puzzle. That's what it was called, their piece. Michael Costa from Los Angeles was the munitions expert on board, and he'd been instructed to make a bootleg fuel-air bomb with some real firepower. Okay, he could do that easily enough. His working model was the BLU-96, often called a daisy cutter, which graphically described the end result. Costa knew that the bomb had originally been designed to clear away minefields, as well as jungles and forests for military landing zones. Then some really crazy sick dude had figured out that the daisy cutter could wipe out people as easily as it could trees and boulders. So now here he was inside an old beat-to-hell cargo plane flying over the Tuscarora mountain range towards Sunrise Valley, Nevada, and they were very close to T, as in target. He and his new best friends were assembling the bomb right there on the plane. They even had a diagram showing how to do it, as if they were idiots. Assembling fuel air bombs for dummies. The actual BLU-96 was a tightly controlled military weapon and relatively hard to obtain, Costa knew. Unfortunately for everybody who lived, loved, ate, slept, and shit in Sunrise Valley, daisy cutters could also be assembled at home out of readily obtainable ingredients. Costa had purchased a 1,000-gallon supplemental fuel bladder, then filled it with high-octane gas, filled a dispersing device, and inserted dynamite sticks as an initiator. Next, he made a motion brake and trigger assembly using a parachutist's altitude deployment device for parts. Simple stuff like that. Then, as he told the others on board the cargo plane, you fly over the target, you push the bomb out the payload door, you run like your pants are on fire and there's an ocean up ahead. Trust me, the daisy cutter will leave nothing but scorched earth below. Sunrise Valley will be a burn mark in the desert, a memory. Just you watch.
Chapter 5.
Easy does it, gentlemen. No one is to be hurt. Not this time.
Nearly 800 miles away, the wolf was watching in live time what was happening in the desert. What a flick. There were four cameras on the ground at Sunrise Valley that were pumping video footage to four monitors in the house in the Bel Air section of Los Angeles where he was staying. For the moment, anyway. He watched closely as the inhabitants of the mobile home park were escorted by army personnel into waiting transport trucks. The clarity of the footage was very good. He could see the patches on the soldiers' arms. Nevada Army Guard Unit 72nd. Suddenly he spoke out loud.
Shit! Don't do that!
He started to squeeze the black handball rapidly in his fist, a habit when he was anxious or angry, or both. One of the male civilians had pulled a gun and had pointed it at a soldier. Incredibly dumb mistake.
You imbecile!
The wolf shouted at the screen.
An instant later, the man with the handgun was dead, face down in the desert dust, which actually made it easier to get the other retards from Sunrise Valley into the transport trucks.
Should have been part of the plan in the first place, the wolf thought. But it hadn't been, so now it was a small problem.
Then one of the handheld cameras focused on a small cargo plane as it approached the town and circled overhead. This was just gorgeous to behold. The handheld was obviously on board one of the army trucks, which were, he hoped, speeding out of range. It was amazing footage. Black and white, which somehow made it even more powerful.
Black and white was more realistic, no?
Yes, absolutely. The handheld was steady on the plane as it glided in over the town.
Angels of death, he whispered. Beautiful image. I'm such an artist.
It took two of them to push the bladder of gas out the payload door. Then the pilot banked a hard left, firewalled the engines, and climbed out of there as fast as he could. That was his job, his piece of the puzzle, and he'd done it very well.
You'll get to live, the wolf spoke to the video again.
The camera was on a wide angle now and captured the bomb as it slowly plummeted toward the town. Stunning footage. Scary as hell, too, even for him to see. At approximately 100 feet from the ground, the bomb detonated.
The fucking bomb, said the wolf.
It just came out of his mouth. Usually, he wasn't this emotional about anything. As he watched, couldn't take his eyes away, the daisy cutter leveled everything within 500 yards of the drop site. It also had the capacity to kill everything within an area that large, which it did. This was utter devastation. Up to 10 miles away, windows blew out of buildings. The ground and buildings shook in Elko, Nevada, about 35 miles away. The explosion was heard in the next state. And actually, much farther away than that. Right there in Los Angeles, for instance. Because tiny Sunrise Valley, Nevada, was just a test run.
This is just a warm-up, said the wolf. Just the beginning of something great. My masterpiece. My payback.
Chapter 6. When everything started, I was blessedly out of the loop, on a 4-day vacation to the West Coast, my first in over a year. First stop, Seattle, Washington. Seattle is a beautiful, lively city that, in my opinion anyway, nicely balances the funky old and the cyber new, with possibly a tip of a Microsoft cap to the future side of things. Under ordinary circumstances, I would have looked forward to a visit there. These were kind of shaky times, though, and I had only to look down at the small boy tightly holding on to my hand as we crossed Wallingford Avenue North to remember why. I had only to listen to my heart. The boy was my son Alex, and I was seeing him for the first time in 4 months. He and his mother lived in Seattle now. I lived in Washington, D.C., where I was an FBI agent. Alex's mom and I were involved in a friendly custody struggle over our son. At least it was evolving that way after a very stormy couple of encounters. You having fun? I asked little Alex, who still carried around Moo, a spotted black and white cow that had been his favorite toy when he lived with me in Washington. He was almost 3, but already a smooth talker and even smoother operator. God, I love this little guy. His mother believed he was a gifted child. High intelligence, high creativity, and since Christine was an elementary school teacher and an excellent one, she would probably know. Christine's place was in the Wallingford area of Seattle, and because it's a pleasant walking neighborhood, Alex and I had decided to stay close to home. We started out playing in the backyard, which was bordered with Douglas firs and had plenty of room, not to mention a view of the Cascade Mountains. I took several pictures of the boy, per my instructions from Nana Mama. Alex wanted me to see his mother's vegetable garden, and as I expected, it was very well done, full of tomatoes, lettuce, and squash. The grass was neatly mown. Pots of rosemary and mint covered the kitchen windowsills. I took more pictures of Alex. After our tour of the yard, we walked over to the Wallingford playfield and had a catch and batting session. Then it was the zoo, and then another hand-holding walk along nearby Green Lake. Alex was pumped up about the upcoming Seafair Kitties parade and didn't understand why I couldn't stay for it. I knew what was coming next, and I tried to brace myself for it.
Why do you always have to go away?
He asked, and I didn't have a good answer. Just a sudden, terrible ache in my chest that was all too familiar. I want to be with you every minute of every day, buddy, I wanted to say. I just do, buddy, I said. But I'll be back soon, I promise. You know I keep my promises.
Is it because you're a policeman?
He asked.
Why you have to go away?
Yes, partly. That's my job. I have to make money to buy VCRs and Pop-Tarts.
Why don't you get another job?
Asked Alex. I'll think about it, I told him. Not a lie. I would. I had been thinking about my police career a lot lately. I'd even talked to my doctor about it. My head doctor. Finally, about 2:30, we made our way back to his house, which is a restored Victorian, painted deep blue with white trim in excellent condition. It's cozy and light and, I must admit, a nice place to grow up in, as is Seattle. Little Alex even has a view of the Cascades from his room. What more could a boy ask for? Maybe a father who's around more than once every few months? How about that? Christine was waiting on the porch, and she welcomed us back warmly. This was such a switch from our last face-to-face in Washington. Could I trust Christine? I guess I had to. Alex and I had a final couple of hugs on the sidewalk. I took a few more snapshots for Nana and the kids. Then he and Christine disappeared inside, and I was on the outside, alone, walking back to my rental car with my hands stuffed deep in my pockets, wondering what it was all about. Missing my small son already, missing him badly, wondering if it would always be as heartbreaking as this, knowing that it would be. Chapter 7. After the visit with Alex in Seattle, I took a flight down to San Francisco to spend some time with Homicide Inspector Jamila Hughes. She and I had been seeing each other for about a year. I missed Jam and needed to be with her. She was good at making things all right. Most of the way, I listened to the fine vocals of Erykah Badu, then Calvin Richardson. They were good at making things right, too. Better, anyway. As the plane got close to San Francisco, we were treated to a surprisingly clear view of the Golden Gate Bridge and the city skyline. I spotted the Embarcadero and the Transamerica building, and then I just let the scene wash over me. I couldn't wait to see Jam. We'd been close ever since we worked a murder investigation together. The only problem, the two of us lived on different coasts. We liked our respective cities and our jobs, and hadn't figured out where to go with that yet. On the other hand, we definitely enjoyed being together. And I could see the joy on Jamila's face as I spotted her near an exit at busy San Francisco International Airport. She was in front of a North Beach deli, grinning, clapping her hands over her head, then jumping up and down. She has that kind of spirit and can get away with it. I smiled and felt better as soon as I saw her. She always had that effect on me. She was wearing a buttery soft leather car coat, light blue tee, and black jeans, and looked as though she'd come straight from work. But she looked good. Really good. She'd put on lipstick and perfume, I discovered as I took her into my arms. Oh, yes, I said. I missed you. Then hold me, hug me, kiss me, she said. How was your boy? How was Alex? He's getting big, smarter, funnier. He's pretty great. I love that little guy. I miss him already, Jamila.
I know you do. I know you do, baby. Give me that hug.
I picked Jam up off her feet and spun her around. She's 5'9" and solid, and I love holding her in my arms. I noticed a few people watching us, and most were smiling. How could they not? Then two of the spectators, a man and a woman in dark suits, walked up to us. Now, what is this? The woman held up her badge for me to see. FBI. Oh, no. No, don't do this to me.
Chapter 8.
I groaned and gently set down Jamila, as if we had been doing something wrong instead of something very right. All the good feelings inside me evaporated in a hurry, just like that. Wham, bam. I needed a break, and this wasn't going to be it. I'm Agent Jean Matthews. This is Agent John Thompson, the woman said, gesturing at a 30-something blonde guy munching a Ghirardelli chocolate bar. We hate to interrupt, to intrude, but we were sent out here to meet your plane. You're Alex Cross, sir, she said, finally thinking to check. I'm Alex Cross. This is Inspector Hughes from the SFPD. You can talk in front of her, I said. Agent Matthews shook her head. No, sir. I'm afraid I can't. Jamila patted my arm. It's okay. She walked away, leaving me with the two agents, which was the opposite of what I wanted to happen. I wanted them to walk away. Far, far away. What's this about? I asked Agent Matthews. I already knew it was something bad, which was an ongoing problem with my current job. FBI Director Burns had my schedule and itinerary at all times, even when I was off duty, which effectively meant that I was never off duty. As I said, sir, we were told to meet you, then to put you right on a plane to Nevada. There's an emergency out there. A small town was bombed. Well, the town was blown off the map. The director wants you on the scene like an hour ago. It's a terrible disaster. I was shaking my head, feeling incredible disappointment and frustration as I walked over to where Jamila stood. I felt as if there was a hole in the center of my chest. There's been a bombing in Nevada. They say it's on the news. I have to go out there, I told her. I'll try to get back as soon as I can. I'm sorry. You have no idea how sorry I am. The look on her face said it all. I understand, she said. Of course I understand. You have to go. Come back if you can. I tried to hug her, but Jamila backed away, finally giving me a small, sad wave. Then she turned and left without saying another word. And I think I knew that I had just lost her, too.
Chapter 9.
I was on the move, but the whole scene felt more than frustrating. It was actually surreal. I flew by private jet from San Francisco to a place called Wells, Nevada, and from there caught a ride in an FBI helicopter to what had once been Sunrise Valley. I was trying not to think about little Alex, trying not to think about Jamila, but so far it wasn't working. Maybe once I got to the bomb site? Once I was there in the action, in the middle of the shit. I could tell by the way the local agents deferred to and fussed around me that my reputation, or the fact that I worked out of Washington, was making them nervous and edgy. Director Burns had made it clear that I was one of the Bureau's troubleshooters, that I was his troubleshooter. I wouldn't carry tales back to Washington, but the agents in the field offices didn't know that. How could they? The helicopter ride from Wells to the bombing site took only about 10 minutes. From the air, I could see emergency lights all around Sunrise Valley, or what had been Sunrise Valley. The town was gone now. There was still smoke, but no fire was visible from the air, possibly because there was nothing left to burn. It was a little past 8 o'clock. what the hell had happened out here? And why would somebody go to the trouble of destroying a hole-in-the-wall town like Sunrise Valley? I had been briefed as soon as I stepped inside the FBI helicopter. Unfortunately, there wasn't too much information available. At 4 that afternoon, the residents, except for one male who'd been shot, had been evacuated by what appeared to be U.S. Army National Guardsmen. The townspeople were then driven 40 miles away to a point halfway to the nearest large town, Elko. Their location was called into the Nevada State Police. By the time the troopers arrived to assist the badly frightened townies, the army trucks and jeeps were gone. And so was the town of Sunrise Valley. Blown off the map. I mean, there was nothing down there but sand and scrub. I could see fire trucks, vans, off-road vehicles, maybe half a dozen helicopters. As our copter began to settle down, I spotted techies in chemical protective overgarments. Jesus, what happened here? Chemical warfare? War? Is that a possibility? In this day and age? Of course it is. Chapter 10. It was probably the scariest thing I'd ever seen in my years as a police officer. Total desolation, without apparent rhyme or reason. As soon as we touched down and I climbed out of the helicopter, I was outfitted in chemical protective overgarments, CPOGs, including a gas mask and other gear. The rubber mask was state-of-the-art, with dual eyepieces and an internal drinking tube for replenishing fluids. I felt like a character in a scary Philip K. Dick story. But it didn't last too long. I took the unwieldy mask off as soon as I saw a couple of army officers roaming around without theirs. We got a possible break soon after I arrived. A couple of rock climbers had spotted a man using a video camera to film the explosion. He looked suspicious, and one of the climbers had photographed the man with his digital camera. The climbers also had shots of the town's evacuation. Two of our agents were interviewing the climbers, and I also wanted to talk to them as soon as the agents had finished. Unfortunately, the local police had gotten to the camera first and were holding it until their chief arrived at the scene. He was late because he'd been away on a hunting trip. When the chief finally got there, in an old black Dodge Polaris, I was all over him. I started talking before he had even climbed out of his car. "Chief, your men are holding important evidence. We need to see it," I said, not raising my voice at the 60-ish pot-bellied man, but making sure he got the point. "This is a federal investigation now. I'm here representing both the FBI and Homeland Security. We've lost valuable time because of your men." To his credit, the police chief himself was exasperated. He began yelling at his officers. "Bring the evidence over here, you morons! What the hell are you two trying to pull? What were you thinking? Do you think? Bring the evidence!" His men came running, and the taller of the two, who I later learned was the chief's son-in-law, handed over the camera. It was a Canon power shot, and I knew how to get at the pictures. "So what do we have here?" The first shots were well-composed nature photos. No people in any of them. Close-ups and wide-angle shots. Then came pictures of the actual evacuation. Unbelievable. Then I finally got my first look at the man who had filmed the explosion. His back was to the camera. At first he was standing, but in the next few shots he was down on one knee, probably to get a better angle. I don't know what had prompted the rock climber to take the initial few shots, but his instincts were pretty good. The mystery man was videotaping the deserted town. Then, suddenly it went up in flames that rose several hundred feet high. It seemed pretty clear that he had known about the attack before it happened. The next photograph showed the man turning in the direction of the climbers. He actually began to walk toward them, or so it appeared on film. I wondered if he'd spotted one of them taking his picture. He seemed to be looking their way. That was when I saw his face, and I couldn't believe what I was looking at. I recognized him. And why not? I'd been chasing him for years. He was wanted for more than a dozen murders here and in Europe. He was a vicious psychopath, one of the worst of his kind still on the loose anywhere in the world. His name was Jeffrey Schaefer, but I knew him better as the Weasel. What was he doing here? Chapter 11. There were a couple more crystal clear shots as the hateful Weasel got closer to the photographer. Just the sight of him sent my brain reeling, and I felt a little sick. My mouth was dry, and I kept licking my lips. What is Schaefer doing here? What connection does he have to the bomb that leveled this small town? It was crazy. Felt like a dream, completely unreal. I'd first come across Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer in Washington 3 years ago. He'd murdered more than a dozen people there, though we could never prove it. He would pose as a cab driver, usually in Southeast, where I lived. The prey was easy to grab, and he knew D.C. police investigations weren't as thorough when the victims were poor and black. Schaefer also had a day job. He was an army colonel working inside the British Embassy. On the face of it, he couldn't have been more respectable. And yet he was a horrible murderer, one of the worst pattern killers I'd ever come across. A local agent named Fred Wade joined me near the helicopter I'd come in on. I was still studying the climber's photos. Wade told me he wanted to know what was going on, and I couldn't blame him. So did I. "The man who videotaped the explosion is named Jeffrey Schaefer," I told Wade. "I know him. He committed several murders in D.C. when I was a homicide detective there. The last we heard of him, he'd fled to London. He murdered his wife in front of their children in a London market. Then he disappeared. Well, I guess he's back. I have no idea why, but it makes my head hurt just to think about it." I took out my cell phone and put in a call to Washington. As I described what I'd discovered, I was reviewing the last few photographs taken of Colonel Schaefer. In one of the photos, he was climbing into a red Ford Bronco. The next was a rear shot of the Bronco as it rode away. Jesus. The license plate was visible. And that was the strangest thing of all so far. The Weasel had made a mistake. The Weasel I'd known didn't make them. So maybe it wasn't a mistake after all. Maybe it was part of a plan.
Chapter 12.
Chapter 12.
The Wolf was still in Los Angeles, but reports were coming in from the Nevada desert on a regular basis. Police arriving near Sunrise Valley, then helicopters, the U.S. Army, finally, the FBI. His old friend Alex Cross was out there now, too. Good for Alex Cross. What a good soldier. Nobody understanding a goddamn thing, of course. No coherent theory about what had happened in the desert. How could there be? It was chaos, and that was the beauty of it. Nothing scared people more than what they didn't understand. Case in point, a local L.A. hotshit named Fyodya Abramstov and his wife Liza. Fyodya wanted to be a big mafia gangster, but also lead the life of a movie star type in Beverly Hills. This was Fyodya in Liza's house that he was staying in now, but really, the Wolf thought of it as his house. After all, their money was his money. Without him, they were nothing but small-time punks with big ambitions. Fyodya and Liza hadn't even known he was at their house. The couple had been at their place in Aspen and finally got back to L.A. at just past 10 that evening. Imagine their surprise. A powerful-looking man sitting by himself in the living room, just sitting there, so peaceful,
rhythmically squeezing a rubber ball in his right hand. They had never seen him before.
"Who the hell are you?" demanded Liza. "What are you doing here?"
The wolf spread his arms. "I am the one who gave you all of this wonderful stuff. And what do you give me in return? Disrespect like this?" "I am the wolf." Fjodja had heard enough already. He knew that if the wolf was there, letting himself be seen, that he and Liza were as good as dead. Best to run and hope to God the wolf is here alone, unlikely as that may be. He took a single step, and the wolf raised a handgun from out of the seat cushion. He was good with a gun. He shot Fjodja Abramstov once in the back, once in the back of his neck. "He's very dead," he calmly said to Liza, which he knew to be a nickname of hers. "I prefer Yelizaveta," he said. "Not so common, so Americanized. Come and sit. Come, please." The wolf patted his lap. "Come. I don't like to repeat myself." The girl was a pretty one, smart too, and apparently ruthless as a snake. She walked across the room and sat in the wolf's lap. She did as she was told, anyway. "Good girl. I like you, Yelizaveta. But what choice do I have? You've disobeyed me. You and Fjodja stole my money. Don't argue. I know it's true." He looked into her beautiful brown eyes. "Do you know Zamoshit?" he asked. "The breaking of bones?" Apparently, Yelizaveta did, because she screamed at the top of her lungs. "This is good," said the wolf as he grabbed the woman's slender left wrist. "Everything is going so well today." He started with Yelizaveta's little finger, just the pinky.
Chapter 13. Had a war started? If it had, who was the enemy? It was pitch black, and it was freezing cold in the desert. Scary and disorienting, to put it mildly. No moon out. Was that part of the plan? What was supposed to happen next? Where? To whom? Why? I tried to collect my thoughts and make a rough plan to take us through the next few hours in at least a semi-organized manner. Difficult to do. Maybe impossible. We were looking for a small convoy of army trucks and jeeps that seemed to have disappeared, to have been gobbled up by the desert. But also a Ford Bronco with the Nevada license tags 322JBP and a sunset design. And we were looking for Jeffrey Schaefer. Why would the weasel be here? While we waited for something to break, maybe a message or a warning, I walked around what had been Sunrise Valley. Where the bomb had actually detonated, buildings and vehicles hadn't just been flattened. They'd been practically vaporized. Little bits of death and destruction, sparks and ash, were still floating in the air. The night sky was masked by a dark and oily cloud of smoke, and I was struck by the unsettling idea that only man could create something like this, and only man would want to. As I wandered through the mounds of debris, I also talked to agents and techs involved in the investigation, and I began to make a few crime scene notes of my own. Bits and pieces of the mobile home camp are scattered everywhere. Witnesses described canisters dropped from a prop plane. One falling can seemed about to strike a trailer home, then exploded in midair above the town. At first, the explosion was like a white, undulating jellyfish cloud. Then the cloud ignited. High winds from the heat of the fire, convection whirls, apparently blew at gale force for several minutes. So far, we had discovered only one body in the rubble. Everyone was wondering the same thing. Why only one? Why spare the others? Why blow up this trailer park town at all? It just didn't make sense. Nothing did so far. but especially Schaefer's presence. One of the local FBI agents, Ginny Moriarty, called out my name and I turned. She waved excitedly for me to come over. Now what? I jogged back to where Agent Moriarty was standing with a couple of local cops. They all seemed exercised about something. "We found the Bronco," she told me. "No army trucks, but we located the Bronco in Wells." "What's in Wells?" I asked Moriarty. "An airport," she answered.
Chapter 14.
Let's go. I was back in the FBI helicopter and headed to Wells in a hurry, hoping to catch up with the Weasel. It seemed like a long shot, but we didn't have anything else. Agents Wade and Moriarty traveled with me. They didn't want to miss this, whatever was waiting in Wells. As we pulled up and away from what remained of Sunrise Valley, I was aware of the high desert. The former town was at an elevation over 4,000 feet. Then I tuned out the surroundings and started thinking about Schaefer, trying once again to figure what could possibly tie him to this mess, this disaster, this murder scene. 3 years before, Schaefer had kidnapped Christine Johnson. It had happened during a family vacation in Bermuda. At the time, Christine and I were engaged to be married. Neither of us knew it, but she was pregnant with Alex when Schaefer abducted her. We were never the same after her rescue. John Sampson, my best friend, and I found her in Jamaica. Christine was emotionally scarred, and of course, I couldn't blame her. Then she moved out to Seattle, where she lived with Alex. And I blamed Schaefer for the custody struggle. Who was he working with? One thing was obvious, and probably useful to the investigation. The firebombing at Sunrise Valley had involved a lot of people. So far, we didn't know who the men and women posing as U.S. Army were, but we did know that they weren't real Army National Guardsmen. Sources at the Pentagon had helped confirm that much. Then there was the matter of the bomb that had leveled the town. Who made it? Probably somebody with military experience. Schaefer had been a colonel in the British Army, but he'd also served as a mercenary. Lots of interesting connections, but nothing very clear yet. The helicopter pilot turned to me. "We should be in visual contact with Wells as soon as we clear these mountains up ahead. We'll see lights anyway, but so will they. I don't think we can sneak up on anybody out here in the desert." I nodded to him. "Just try to land as close as you can to the airport. We'll coordinate with the state troopers. We might draw fire," I added. "Understood," the pilot said. I started to discuss our options with Wade and Moriarty. Should we try to land at the airport itself or nearby in the desert? Had either of them fired their weapons before or been fired on? I found out they hadn't. Neither of them. Terrific. The pilot turned to us again. "Here we go. Airport should be coming up on our right. There." Suddenly, I could see a small airfield with a two-story building and what looked like two airstrips. I spotted cars, maybe half a dozen, but I didn't see a red Bronco yet. Then I saw a small private plane taxiing and getting ready for takeoff. Schaefer? It didn't seem likely to me, but neither did anything else so far. "I thought we shut down Wells," I called to the pilot. "So did I. Maybe this is our boy. If it is, he's gone. That's a Learjet 55, and it moves pretty damn good." From that moment on, there was very little we could do but watch. The Learjet shot down one of the runways, then it was airborne, winging away from us and making it look ridiculously easy. I could imagine Jeffrey Schaefer on board, looking back at the FBI helicopter, maybe giving us the finger. Or was he giving me the finger? Could he know that I was here? A few minutes later, we were on the ground at Wells. Almost immediately, I got the jolting news that the Learjet was off radar. "What do you mean, off radar?" I asked the two techies inside the tiny Wells control room. The older of the two answered, What I mean is that the jet seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. It's like it was never here. But the weasel had been there. I'd seen him. And I had photographs to prove it.
Chapter 15.
Chapter 15.
Jeffrey Schaefer drove a dark blue Oldsmobile Cutlass full bore through the desert. He wasn't on board the jet that had flown out of Wells, Nevada. That would have been too easy. Weasels always have several escape routes planned. As he drove, Schaefer was thinking that the oddly brilliant plan in the desert had worked well, and there had certainly been backup contingencies just in case something didn't work right. He had also learned that Dr. Cross, now with the FBI, had shown up in Nevada. Is that part of the big picture, too? Somehow, he expected that it was. But why Cross? What does the wolf have in mind for him? The weasel eventually made a stop in Fallon, Nevada, where he was scheduled to make his next contact. He didn't know exactly who he was contacting, or why, or where this whole operation was leading. He just knew his piece. And his explicit orders were to call in from Fallon and get the next set of instructions. So he followed his orders, registered at the Best in Fallon, and went straight to his room. He used a cell phone, which he'd been told to destroy after he made the call. There were no pleasantries exchanged, no unnecessary words, just the business at hand.
"This is the wolf,"
he heard as contact was made, and Schaefer wondered if that was so. According to rumor, the real wolf had impersonators, maybe even body doubles, all of them with their piece, right? Next, he heard disturbing news.
"You were seen, Colonel Schaefer. You were spotted and photographed near Sunrise Valley. Did you know that?"
At first, Schaefer tried to deny it, but he was cut off.
"We're looking at copies of the pictures right now. That's how the Bronco was followed to Wells, which is why we told you to exchange vehicles outside town and drive to Fallon, just in case something went wrong."
Schaefer didn't know what to say. How could he have been spotted out in the middle of nowhere? Why was Cross there? The wolf finally laughed.
"Oh, don't worry your pretty head, Colonel. You were supposed to be spotted. The photographer works for us. Now, proceed to your next contact point in the morning. And have some fun tonight in Fallon. Paint the town, Colonel. I want you to go and kill somebody out in the desert. You choose a victim. Do your stuff. That's an order."
Chapter 16. The level of frustration and tension I was feeling was increasing by the hour, and so was the general confusion about the case. I'd never seen so much chaos so fast in my entire life. Almost a full day after the bombing, there was nothing but a hole in the ground in the Nevada desert and a couple of questionable leads. We had talked to 300 or so residents of Sunrise Valley, but none of the survivors had a clue either. Nothing unusual had happened in the days before the bombing. No stranger had visited. We hadn't found the army vehicles or discovered where they had come from. What had happened in Sunrise Valley still didn't make sense. Neither did Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer's being there. But it sure shook us up. No one had even taken credit for the bombing yet. After 2 days, there wasn't too much more I could do out in the desert, so I caught a ride home to Washington. I found Nana, the kids, even Rosie the cat out on the front porch waiting for me. Home, sweet home again. Why didn't I just learn a lesson and stay there? "This is real nice," I said, beaming as I bounded up the steps. "A welcoming committee. I guess everybody missed me, right? How long you been out here waiting for your pops?" Nana and the kids shook their heads pretty much in unison, and I smelled conspiracy. Nana said,
Of course, we're glad to see you, Alex. And finally cracked a smile. They all did. Conspiracy for sure. Gotcha, said Janny, who is 10 now. She had on a crocheted sun hat with her braids hanging out. Of course we're your welcoming committee. Of course we missed you, Daddy. Who wouldn't? Got you bad, Damon taunted from his perch on the rail. He's 12 and looks the part. Sean John t-shirt, straight leg jeans, hip towns. I pointed a finger at him. I'll get you, you break my porch rail. Then I smiled. Gotcha, I said to Damon. After that, I had to answer all sorts of questions about little Alex and show around my digital camera with dozens of pictures of our beloved little man. Everybody was pretty much laughing now, which was better. And it was definitely good to be home again, even if I was still waiting for more news about the bombing in Nevada and about Schaefer's involvement. Nana had held dinner for me, and after a delicious meal of roast chicken with garlic and lemon, squash, mushrooms, and onions, the family congregated in the kitchen over cleanup and bowls of ice cream. Janny showed off a pen and ink of her heroes, Venus and